This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to The Shift, the podcast that aims to tell the no-holds-barred truth about being a woman post-40. Created and hosted by me, writer and broadcaster, Sam Baker. My guest this week and the final guest of this season is the first female main presenter of Channel 4 News, Cathy Newman. Cathy joined Channel 4 News as political correspondent in 2006 after more than a decade working in newspapers, including The Independent, The Financial Times and The Washington Post. She's an award-winning investigative journalist whose scoops include the sexual harassment allegations against the Liberal Democrat peer Lord Renard. But that's just the first 4 days of the week. On the fifth, she hosts her own show on Times Radio. And on the side, she's a pretty accomplished amateur violinist. But Google her name, and will you see all those achievements? Nuh-uh. Just reams and reams of the kind of internet abuse that will be familiar to almost every woman in the public eye.
I do feel that turning 50, I do feel that age and wisdom that I've accrued over the last 30 years of journalism is a bit of a superpower. I do feel that I'm coming into my own.
Cathy joined me to talk about her new book, The Ladder, and why The Ladder doesn't work for women or minorities and probably never has, her own personal sliding doors moment, sexual harassment, and discovering she was paid less than the bloke at the next desk. We also discussed learning not to give a monkey's about internet trolls, menopause, heavy periods, HRT, and why turning 50 really does feel like a superpower to her.
So what were the kind of the parental expectations, you know, the family, the accepted family norms growing up?
Well, my parents were, you know, both teachers, so they were very keen in learning. And one of their big things, my mum read this book when we were growing up called, I think it's called The Children Who Lived on the Hill or something. And it was about, it was a kind of book for educationalists, really. And the whole mantra was that any, if your child was good at something, you'd sort of give them all the tools they needed to excel at that thing. And that informed really the way that she mothered us, which was, for example, early on, I was really interested in music. So, you know, she got me violin lessons really when I was really young. I must have been, I think I started the piano at 4 and I wasn't very good at the piano. And then I'd started the violin at 5. And then she kind of like threw everything at that. So I ended up going up to London for lessons every Monday night with an amazing Texan woman called Donna Lee Croft, who was an incredible role model, actually. She lived in a house full of cats, and I loved cats. And she had this kind of great shop of auburn hair. She actually still, I think she still teaches at the Royal College of Music. So she was an incredible violinist. I learned so much from her. But that was my mum's attitude, you know, supported by my dad. It's very much whatever your kids express an interest in, make it possible for them to do that. So that's how I ended up, you know, doing a lot of music. There was a point where I tried out for the Yehudi Menuhin School and, you know, that it was all that kind of it was all, I'm sort of glad now there was a bit of a crossroads where I either went to a music school or I sort of, music had to take a bit of a backseat. And in the end, we decided music had to take a bit of a backseat. I'm glad now that I made that decision, because I look at my friends who did go on to become musicians, and I think it is a really, really hard life. Amazing life, you know, doing what you love. And, you know, I'd still love playing the violin, but I'm glad. I think it was the right decision not to go down that route, because music schools are such a sort of hothouse, very intense environment. And really, I think it's quite hard to go to a music school and then catch up with your academics and go somewhere else. So that was, music was a massive part of my childhood. It was a bit of an escape, actually, because I didn't really enjoy school. I went to a girls' school initially. I went to local mixed comprehensive initially, and then a girls' private school, which I really hated, and then a boys' public school. It was like commuter belt. I didn't like all girls, the atmosphere of all girls together. And I think now I love being amongst women, and there's such a sort of camaraderie and support amongst female networks, as I talk about in the book. But in those days, at that age, I think all girls together can be quite toxic. So I didn't really enjoy that. And I then went to a boys' public school on a scholarship. So my dad taught there, so we got money off the fees anyway. And then I supplemented that with a couple of scholarships, music scholarship, one of them. And so we didn't pay any fees. So it felt like this amazing kind of bargain, going to it's been like 35 grand a year school and not paying fees. But I wasn't very happy there, because if you're the child of a teacher, you're instantly slightly singled out. And then also, I was a bit of a boffin. So
you were sexually harassed there as well, weren't you?
Yeah. And at the time, and I've talked about that since, that at the time I wouldn't even have known that's what it was. You know, you didn't even put a label on things like that in those days. I just knew, you know, that I was sitting around the dinner table and this guy whopped out his penis and put a hand on it. And, you know, I was just talking away, not really thinking about what I was doing. And then suddenly I was like, I felt like such a fool. You know, I felt, it's that thing where something happens and you immediately blame yourself. I felt like a bit of an idiot, you know. And now, you know, I talked about that a few years ago. And the police called me up and said, you know, the school encouraged me to report it. And I just thought, I'm not going to report something like that all these years later, when, you know, the boy was a boy and I was 16, 17, something like that. But yeah, so that was the atmosphere of how the boys treated the girls in that school at that time.
Yeah, were there many girls? Were it just girls in sixth
just
form?
Just girls in sixth form. So it was very, very much a male-dominated environment. And
so you went from one extreme to the other then, like from an all-girls school to effectively an all-boys school.
Neither of which I would recommend. And in fact, both our kids have gone to a mixed comprehensive school in London. And, you know, I hope have had a much happier experience than I did. And that was partly why we made that decision. My husband also went to a kind of boys prep school and wasn't very happy there. So, you know, it's what you do. You kind of try and do something different for your own kids, don't you? But yeah, I also think I probably wouldn't have been happy at any school. It was one of those things that...
One of those kids.
Yeah, I just, you know, I was impatient to kind of grow up and get out there. And, you know, I loved the idea of working and being paid to work, and that sounded great. So I also think I'm not very good at being part of an institution either. And, you know, schools are fundamentally institutional, aren't they? And I'm just not very good at sort of toeing the line and being part of a crowd. So I think I probably wouldn't be happy anywhere.
You were a clever swotty girl.
I was clever and swotty, yeah, which is never a good look. Yeah, although now I think it's okay to be clever and swotty, actually. I think kids
probably
now...
It still depends on your school, don't you?
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. It's interesting that I go to a lot of state schools to do talks, and I notice that girls who are clever... I know, you're right. It depends on the school. But the schools, quite a number of the schools that I go to, it is actually a badge of pride to be doing well at school and getting good grades and to be ambitious in a way that it wasn't when we were growing up.
No, definitely not when I was at school. That was like...
Death. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So when did you decide you wanted to be a journalist? When did you kind of decide that music wasn't the way forward and maybe journalism was?
Yeah, I think it must have been that crossroads that I talked about where I was sort of thinking about going to a music school must have been about 11 or 12-ish. But at that point, I thought I could still be a violinist. But actually, I wasn't going to be good enough. I wasn't going to be totally focused enough. So I think it must have been when I was about 16, during the first Gulf War. I think those dates are right. It's hard to remember, isn't it? But Kate, I hadn't had a telly up to that point because we grew up. That was sort of almost part of the atmosphere of homes that my parents thought the TV was a big distraction. Anyway, my great aunt had an old black and white telly that you had to sort of stick a coat hanger in the top and to make it work. And we had one of them, and I saw Kate Ady presenting from Iraq during the war with a flak jacket on. And I kind of thought, wow, that looks like a really cool job. So actually, I that was my first thought about being journalism, was actually being a war reporter, which ironically, I've never been a war reporter because I kind of got distracted with politics and all sorts of other journalism. So that's something that maybe I'll be a war reporter next. Maybe in 15, I'll do it at the end of my career. Like when I'm 65, I'll go and be a war reporter. But yeah, so that was when I had that first idea that journalism was a career.
And how did you get into it? Because it's quite the leap, isn't it? You know, at that point particularly, I don't know what it's like. I mean, I don't know how you would even get into journalism now because journalism is such a, you know, other thing. Now, what's left of it? I mean, print journalism is a bit decimated. But at that time, it was very much Oxbridge-y and, you know, you might fluke into it by learning to type like I did, but particularly the area of it that you're in, the kind of serious journalism.
Yeah, no, it was really, you're right, it was really tough. I remember when I was, must have been when I was after university or when I was at school, but I should have checked my date, shouldn't I? But anyway, I wrote round all the local newspapers and I got turned down by everybody except my parents were in the process of moving down to North Devon, Somerset. So I wrote to the North Devon Journal and they said, yes, I can come do work experience. So that was my first work experience. It was absolutely brilliant. I loved, they trusted me with so much. They just sent me off to report on everything from the kind of local fate. The best story was they said that someone had called in saying that they discovered blood on a clifftop path in the Valley of the Rocks. It's an incredibly scenic location. I don't know if you know it, but it's very dramatic. And so this pool of blood had been found and a murder inquiry had been launched. What they discovered was that it was actually the council had gone out at dawn without telling anyone and slaughtered a whole load of wild goats who live in the Valley of the Rocks. And so then there was this big outcry, why hadn't they told anyone? And of course, they didn't want anyone to know because they were worried that sort of animal lovers would come and camp on their doorsteps and campaign. And there was a massive outcry. Why had the council done this without consulting the local population? And it was just, I loved that story. It got picked up by the Mirror. So it felt like my first scoop. And it was just one of those classic stories where someone in authority isn't telling you what's really going on. And so many of the stories I've done since, that is the kind of heart of it. So it taught me so much just doing that story on work experience. So I did that, but that, you know, obviously that was just work experience. I wasn't paid for it or anything. And I just got my first job by applying to an ad in The Guardian for a researcher on The Independent. And I remember the minimum wage hadn't come in yet, but there was a lot of discussion about it. And I remember actually working out that what I was getting paid was below what the minimum wage was supposed to be when it came in. So it wasn't, I think it was 200 quid a week, I think. It might have been 150. So it was a total. And I remember sort of asking about the salary, like, actually, that would be below the minimum wage. It wasn't illegal because the minimum wage hadn't come in at that point. And I remember the sort of person who was in charge of the department saying, yeah, a few of the candidates asked about that. But that is what it is, I'm afraid. And, you know, it's seen as very much a starter job. And it was a great job because it was researching on the news analysis page, which was this huge feature, you know, news feature, where the best writers on the paper were picked to do this fantastic kind of analysis of a story of the week. And it was really, my job was incredibly hard because obviously the internet didn't exist at that point. So it would be like, I would have to do the kind of box of like accompanying text. So if it was a news analysis about tourism in the UK or whatever, I would have to come up with the top 10 tourist attractions in the UK. Now you could do that in minutes. Then it was literally, I was on the phone to a zillion people, fact checking. Sometimes the information was just so hard to come by that, you know, I would go into the boss, who was quite a tough character, and say, look, I've only been able to find 7 or whatever. I can't get to 10. And he'd go, well, that's not very good, is it? And kind of bawl me out. And that would take me the whole day, is finding that kind of fact box and researching the piece. So it was really, it was a real baptism of fire. I made lots of contacts, which enabled me after my, I had a 6-month contract and the Independent was in a bit of a state at that time. So it was quite clear I wasn't going to get trained up as a reporter there. So I went off to a trade magazine called Media Week, which I don't know whether it even exists anymore. And that's, I mean, again, that was brilliant training because I just, I learned how to kind of work a patch and have contacts and break stories. So I did 1.5 years on that. And then because I'd made lots of contacts back at the Independent, I just sort of called up someone who I used to know there and said, look, I've done this 1.5 years learning how to be a reporter. Are there any jobs going? And I got a job back on the Independent as a media business reporter. And in a way, that was the start, the real start of my career, because that was proper reporting, breaking stories, you know, finding scoops, that kind of thing.
At what point do you think did you decide or work out who you were and who you were going to be in, I suppose, in the professional context, but also in the personal context?
Do any of us know who we are?
No, I don't, but I'm looking to you, Kathy, to be a guiding light.
I think, you know what? I feel relatively recently, actually, because I've had sort of several incarnations. So when I was very happy at the FT when I was a media correspondent, loved that job, knew exactly what I wanted to do with it, break stories, make contacts. And then I suppose I really found a home in Westminster when I was political correspondent and then chief political correspondent, because I just love Westminster stories. And, you know, I love all the kind of like skullduggery and, you know, the characters in Westminster and the kind of, you know, treachery and betrayal. And so I loved all of that. So I kind of, I suppose I made a home for myself there. And you could say, well, that's part of in my DNA, doing those kind of stories and interviewing politicians. I kind of really felt I was on a roll at cruising altitude, as you might put it. I got my wings and everything. When I was several years into presenting on Channel 4 and I was juggling kind of breaking the odd story investigation, like the John Smythe investigation about the friend of the Archbishop of Canterbury's who beat boys until they bled all in the name of religion. So, you know, doing stories like that and also presenting and doing big interviews and things like that, I thought, right, okay, I'm happy doing this. And that is, I mean, I've added Times Radio to my portfolio, but, you know, that's, and I obviously do the books, but that was, I suppose that's what who I am professionally, interviews, scoops, and juggling the two. Personally, I think having children is when you really sort of work out in your essence what you want, who you are. You know, I met my husband when I was 18, so really young. And, you know, we're real soulmates and we've grown together rather than grown apart, which is a relief. But I suppose those first years after university are very, yeah, I found them very stressful. And my first job at the Independent was very stressful. And I got shingles and I was very run down and it was very hard to live on the salary I was paid in London. And, you know, I got followed home from the tube by someone and I found London very scary, very unhealthy place to live. And I think, you know, a lot of people who are struggling in their first jobs find London very hard to live now because it's so expensive. You're living in an absolute dump. You know, you're probably living on a main road and breathing in loads of fumes. And, you know, so that was quite a hard time, I think, personally. Once we had our first child, and I think I got used to the idea of how to juggle being a parent, doing my job. I went back to work. That went well. I was happy with that idea of I didn't want to stay at home for longer than 6 months because I would have gone absolutely mad. And so I was quite keen to getting back to work and making that work, making sure I saw enough of our baby, but also I was able to return to work and sort of fire on as many cylinders as I could.
And did your husband right from the start take the lead on?
Our first child we had
stuff.
Well, we had an amazing nanny for about 8 years who was still is a really good family friend. So she was incredible. Matsy, Martina, Czech, young woman when she started out. She's grown up with us now, got her own children. But yeah, she was incredible. And then between our first and second, well, we actually lost several babies. But then just before we were having our second, Molly, John got made redundant from Time Out. So he then worked from home and juggled childcare and working. So that was quite a big change. People always have that thing, don't they? You can't have it all. And you can't, you know, there are sacrifices that I made in that I haven't been present for parts of the children's lives, of course, and the sacrifices that John made because he's not developed his career in the way I've been able to. But by and large, I think it wouldn't have worked so well as a family if we'd both been out to work long hours. You know, everybody makes their own choices when it comes to that. But I think it is quite hard to be really engaged with your kids' lives if you're both out until late every night. It's pretty difficult.
Yeah, I've been thinking about a lot actually about the kind of have it all, because I'm a little bit older than you, and that so I feel like I really started work in that kind of at the tail end of that have it all 80s, you know, power suiting, ball breaking thing. And then into the kind of really weird Ladette era. When in both of those contexts, you were meant to be a bloke, basically.
Yeah. I think until quite recently, you know, that was the idea of female power, was basically emulating male power. I think it's really, I would say even within the last 5 years, that especially in my industry, that, you know, you don't have to interview like an aggressive man. You know, you can interview in a different way. And that might actually yield more interesting results. And I do see female bosses now doing things differently from the male bosses. And that's quite refreshing. But yeah, you're right. It was always in the past was just to ape men, wasn't it?
Yeah. And I think, I mean, you know, like you were just saying, I mean, I definitely think it was like for my entire, and I'm sorry to listeners who've heard me say this a dozen times before, but my entire career was spent shoving a tampon up my sleeve to go to the loo. And, you know, and when I went through perimenopause, you know, there's no way, even though I worked in an almost entirely female environment, there was no way on earth I was going to say, I'm having a hot flush, sorry. Or I've got to go and stick my head out of a window. Or who's stolen my can of Diet Coke out of the fridge because I wasn't going to drink that. I was going to shove it up my toilet. But now all of those things seem...
Yeah.
Like, you're right. It's probably only the last 5 years.
Yeah.
That shift has,
yeah, I think it is a really positive shift. And I'm quite interested to see what the next 5 years looks like in terms of the next generation of female bosses who have, you know, grown up professionally in that environment. And I do think the other really positive thing that when I first started out in that quite, I mean, the Independent didn't feel horrendously male dominated, but the FT was very male dominated when I started. Now, it was a very, you know, it was a very nurturing newspaper in many ways. But, you know, I've said before that lots of the male colleagues asked me to do the photocopying because they just assumed I was a PA. You know, so there was that kind of environment.
But did that change as you got more senior or?
Well, I mean, no one asked me to do the photocopying because they knew that I was bringing in stories and I was a political correspondent and then I was chief. So people knew who I was by that point. Yeah, I mean, I'd love to see what Ula Hauff's FT is like, you know, now she's at the helm.
Have you ever had a female boss?
Yeah, I've got a female boss now. And
well, you've got Alex now.
Well, Alex Mahon is at Channel 4, but ITN, Esme Wren is editor.
Oh, of course. Yeah. I always forget that Channel 4 News is made by ATN.
Yeah. So she actually was my first female boss. So that's quite interesting after all these years. Oh, no, that's not true. No, I had Media Week. I had a female boss. Yeah. But she was definitely a female boss who, you know, who modelled herself on the male bosses, whereas Esme does do it differently. And it is, you know, it's refreshing. I've got to say that because I've got to be nice about her. So
Yeah, absolutely.
No, it's true though. She has a very different style from my former male bosses, and it is really, yeah, it's a marked change in the last few years.
There's so many women I know of between, you know, roughly my age, your age. Say they now, and I absolutely feel like this. You look back on your certainly early days. Do you know what? Not even the early days of your career, most of your career, and you just think, what was I thinking? Just letting that happen, putting up with that. Did you have those moments?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Definitely. I mean, I've said before at the FT, actually, when I found out that someone was hired in a more junior job to the one that I was in, and I knew that what they were on because they were a friend of mine, and I'd recommended that they be hired, and they did hire him. And so I found out he was getting paid 10 grand more than me and went in to confront the editor. The sort of section editor, who shall remain nameless, and he said, well, what do you need money for? You don't have a mortgage or a family. And I did get the pay rise overnight, but it was, yeah, I feel now, I mean, I suppose I feel proud that I did challenge it even then. I wasn't going to shut up about that. And, you know, there were senior women on the paper, like Alice Rawsthorne, for example, who was sort of an unofficial mentor to me. She was a design writer. And I'm sure people like her, I can't remember if she actually said, well, you're not going to let that lie, are you? But that was very much her mentality, not to take any crap. So I think that I did have kind of unofficial mentors looking out for me. But, you know, there were things like there was someone from ad sales at Media Week who sort of chased me around the office trying to pinch my bum. You know, there's all this stuff that, yeah, I would definitely handle things differently now. And I would definitely have been more vocal about making sure that I was getting equal pay, for example. I mean, at ITN, there were a bunch of us who did, you know, draw attention to the gender pay gap, and, you know, that yielded results, so it's better now. But I feel that now, it's kind of accepted that women will make sure they're not being taken for granted or maltreated or not given equal treatment. Whereas at the time, it was almost like a bit sort of daring and a bit trailblazing to take on the boss in that way.
It's relatively recent, isn't it? I think it's, you know, I mean, I know certainly somebody I know who works in the city was basically told that she wasn't getting as big a bonus as a younger guy. She's probably about my age, because he had a family.
Wow. And this was recent.
Yeah. Well, it was when I was writing The Shift, so probably 4 years ago. So she was, you know, and I do think that there are still pockets of it. Still, this idea that as a woman you don't have the, well, like your boss said to you during the ITN thing, you've got nice shoes, Kathy. You don't need a pay rise. Can you imagine?
He got
a bloke.
He got quite a pay sting for that, though. Yeah. I mean, that incident that happened at the FT. God, when would that have been? I mean, 25 years ago or something. So I'm very surprised to hear that happening now, or, you know, a few years back. But yeah, that is a recognition that things still need to change, don't they?
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Well, One of the things that you write about in the book, you know, it's about appearance and the way women are judged on it. And I think, have you felt that? Because you work, particularly since you've been, you know, the lead female face.
Yeah.
Have you felt like that's an issue for you?
I haven't. And I feel that, well, I feel two things. One, maybe I've been lucky. And, you know, I do think Channel 4 News is very supportive in that way that, yeah, that's never been raised with me. And I don't really feel I've got a lot of trolling on that point yet. But I suppose that's my other thought is I'm turning 50 this year. You know, will that be something that becomes an issue? But I kind of hope not, because I mean, I do, and I do feel that turning 50, I do feel that age and wisdom that I've accrued over the last 30 years of journalism is a bit of a superpower. I do feel that I'm coming into my own, you know, and I've in a way that older blokes are sort of venerated for their wisdom. I sort of hope that will happen to older women, because I feel I've got so much more experience and knowledge now than I ever did at any other point in my career. So there is definitely still a double standard out there that, you know, George Clooney can be a sexy, wise silver fox at 62. Whereas, you know, and there was a big documentary about David Bowie when he turned 50. And you kind of think, well, there wasn't something like that for Kate Bush when she turned 50. And there's that sense that when women turn 50, particularly if they're in the public eye, they're on telly, whatever, it's kind of like, oh, well, when's she going to pack up and hide? And when's she going to get plastic surgery or whatever? And so I haven't felt that pressure. I suppose I'm braced for it, but I'm also braced with my response, which is that I've got so much more to offer now than I did when I was 30. I know so much more, and I know what I'm doing more. And I, as also, you don't, Caroline Noakes says this in the book, the MP, because she said, you know, she has so much more confidence post 50. I think she's post 50 than before. I think imposter syndrome plagues women much more than men, because we're not given that kind of confidence boost, whether it's at school or, you know, we have to struggle for our authority. And so you end up kind of doubting yourself much more. Well, all of that goes really when you approach 50, because you've proved that you can do it, and you've proved that you know what you're talking about. So, yeah, I mean, sure, I don't like the wrinkles and the bags and all of that. And, you know, the grey hairs, I don't love that. But I also want to look like a 50-year-old woman. I just want to look good for my 50 years.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, actually, would you go grey, not go grey because of your job?
Well, I've always highlighted my hair, so that for me is not an age thing. I wouldn't go grey just because I'm quite pale, and I just think I suit that blonde look. I've got blue eyes, you know, otherwise I would have been a slightly mousy blonde for forever. And I just made that decision that, you know, I've always highlight my hair, and I'll carry on highlighting it. Obviously, I have to work a bit harder to hide the odd bit of grey, but yeah, I don't think grey is me.
So have you been through menopause?
Well,
through perimenopause?
I mean, empowered by Davina McCall, who's one of the interviewees in the book, she had this great thing that, you know, I think she even says in your late 30s, you should go and get your hormones checked and everything. So, well, I was a bit later than that. I was kind of, I think it must be my late 40s. I was like, right, well, I'm going to do what Davina says. So I thought it'd be good to try out how women friendly my doctor's surgery was. And it turned out they were very. I just phoned up the GP and said, yeah, I want a blood test for my hormone levels, which I did. And they were kind of okay, you know, nothing terrible, which was, I didn't really have any symptoms. Well, I had like really heavy bleeding and had the Mirena coil fitted. And that was a miracle, because it was getting to the point where I was so anemic and I was passing out because of blood loss. So that was a while back. That was a kind of post-kids thing. But then, yeah, I the hormones were kind of inconclusive. So I kind of suspected I might have a few little symptoms. I don't know whether I was kind of talking myself into it. Anyway, I did HRT. I feel fine. I'm still doing HRT and I haven't noticed anything different really. So, well, I think, you know, maybe thanks to Davina, I've just sort of like smoothed that whole thing. So I still feel like a woman in her late 30s. That's great. I'm happy with that. Or maybe I'm about to hit and it's going to be absolutely awful. But either way.
No, I mean, the reason I asked is because when you were talking about the kind of, you know, approaching 50 and feeling, you know, effectively more confident and like you have more to offer and more, it's very much something that I hear from women who have gone through it, who are kind of at a point where they're like, well, yeah, this is me. And, you know, and I do think, you know, that thing of the, you know, the male silver, I mean, there's still the whole like male silver fox, George Clooney thing, but definitely that, well, you know, Jon Snow still presenting in his early 70s or John Humphrey or any, you know, any of those older generation male newsreaders, you just couldn't imagine there being a woman like that. Now it doesn't seem as inconceivable.
Yeah, I think so. I really do think that. And I do think also there's like, you know, there's older models, aren't there, with grey hair and like funky glasses, as you say, and like bright lipstick. And they're not going to pretend to be old. They're going to vamp it up and look great. And I do think that is a real shift. And I really want to keep that shift going for self-interest apart from anything else. But yeah, you know, it's, I think, you know, women can be really attractive into 50s, 60s, just as the men can. I don't see why that should be a problem. I think, you know, Davina McCall and Carolyn Harris have done an amazing job campaigning, you know, Mariella Frostrop as well, my Times Radio colleague. You know, they've done an amazing job sort of getting us all talking about the menopause in a way that we didn't. But yeah, you can really sort of like roar into your 50s and be kind of powerful and sexy and dynamic and successful. And that's great. I'm all in for that.
I just want to talk a little bit about the ladder and the kind of phrase, the ladder, because I've been kind of thinking about it over the last couple of days. And it's so, isn't it interesting that we're still using that phrase? And it's a phrase that feels so designed by and for men, like all about upwards with the blinkers on. Those blinkers, if for most women and Black people and queer people and, you know, differently abled people and working class people, those blinkers aren't a possibility.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I completely, and actually one of the things that I found interviewing all the women for the ladder was that I don't think any of them a straight route up the ladder, one rung after the other. So in a way, the title is kind of poking fun at myself, Freedom Talking About the Ladder. It's quite a nice visual metaphor. There you are, you know, you're scaling the heights and you're dodging the snakes as well. But yeah, there is no, I don't think there should be. It's kind of encouraging to me that all the women say, well, you know, like Nisha Katona, who founded Mowgli Street Food, she tried several different, you know, she was a disappointment to her parents, she says, because she didn't succeed in the careers that they wanted. She tried being a lawyer, and it was only then that she came to setting up restaurants, Mowgli Street Food, amazing branch of restaurants. You know, she is typical. Try out lots of different things, take a very circuitous route, and then find out what you're good at. I mean, Jude Kelly, you know, the South Bank Centre and founder of the Women of the World Festival, amazing, impressive woman. She says, you know, don't even think about climbing the ladder or a career structure. Just find what you enjoy and what you're passionate about and kind of follow your nose, really. And I found that inspiring to hear about, because there's something very daunting for young girls and women in particular. And I do a lot of talks at schools. For them sort of feeling, oh, I've got to get all these nines at GCSEs, I've got to get all my A stars at A levels, and then I've got to go to the best university, and then I've got to get the best job. And it's just, you can be kinder to yourself than that. You can find out what you're interested in, what really makes you tick. What would be worse than landing up in a very successful job that you're bored to tears with within years, and then you've got to do it for the rest of your life? I find it liberating talking to these women who have sort of hit on, you know, Sue Chung, for example, writer. She was told that her writing was hopeless because English wasn't her first language. And she had to work terrible long hours serving takeaways in her parents' takeaway outlet. And she, you know, she blossomed by sort of giving herself space to create. And I think that, yeah, is liberating and inspiring.
I mean, you say you have to believe the ladder is worth climbing. And I think there are kind of two things out there. It's not just, I mean, you definitely see a lot in young people that they're just like, well, the whole system is so stacked against us that why would I bother, you know, doing that, putting myself through that? I need to get somewhere, if I got there, and still not be able to afford to buy a house. But something I see, I hear loads from women on the shift is that they kind of get to, I'm going to say this stage of life, but that's, you know, it's a big stage. And then either decide to jump right off, even from quite near the top, or to build their own, you know, very small, like, I mean, really, we're talking tables, not ladders, but, you know, it's a furniture. We're in a furniture space. You know, why do you think that is?
There's a both positive and a negative out of that. I think the negative is that women get tired of fighting and getting their sharp elbows out and having to sort of maneuver their way in a way that, you know, things are sort of handed to maybe a lot of men in their workplace on a plate, and, you know, they've had to fight much harder, and that's exhausting. So I think that's the negative response to that. The positive response goes back to what I was saying about approaching your 50s and feeling like you care less. Like, I, you know, all of those social media trolling episodes that women have to deal with and I've had to deal with, you know, that's really the first time that happens, you feel really like floored by it. And then the second time it happens, you're like, oh, whatever. And now I barely even look at the at notifications on Twitter or X, partly because it sort of matters less, but also because I don't care, you know. And that is a liberating thing about what you're saying. Maybe women are reaching that point and going, I'm going to do what I want to do and what I enjoy doing, not what I feel like I ought to do. I mean, you know, some women don't have that luxury if they're having to keep earning a certain amount, obviously. But I do think there is something that the older you get, the more you're aware of life being precious. And, you know, obviously we've all known colleagues and friends who have died prematurely from cancer or whatever it is. And so I think you do have that sort of awareness that you want to spend your life in a meaningful way. So that's the kind of positive response, I think. I mean, you're right that I'm sitting here saying I feel much more confident and I care less about what people think about me and whether they judge me. That isn't everybody's experience approaching 50. And, you know, some people talk about going through the menopause and feeling very anxious and very lonely. And obviously, you know, women who have sort of maybe broken up from a partner, you know, they've managed to bring up the kids perhaps on their own. And then they're like, well, what now? What's for me? So I'm not saying everybody shares this experience, but I feel that I learned so much from talking to the women on the ladder about the positives of aging and gaining wisdom and experience.
And what does success look like for you now?
Well, that's something that, again, I found really interesting talking to the women in the book, because like singer Melanie C, for example, she was incredibly successful at an incredibly young age, you know, all those chart-topping songs, and she was around the world on a tour. But she says she was absolutely miserable at that point because it was stressful, and she was grappling with eating issues. And she says now she defines success as happiness. And I kind of feel slightly similarly, actually. You can sort of slog away and get to the pinnacle of your profession and be lauded for that. But actually, I think success, the older you become, is more nuanced. And success might be having the freedom to take a day off when you want to take a day off and do something amazing with your kids, or devote some time to your partner, or, you know, just living your life slightly more flexibly. Maybe having the financial freedom to drop a day at work, whatever, that might be success. So I kind of think for me, success is achieving a balance, and I'm not very good at that. And every year, my New Year's resolution is the same, which is to say no to more things. And I find it very hard to do that, but that doesn't mean I stop trying. So I think success is probably to just concentrate on the things that really matter and that are really important to me. And that's what I hope success at 50 looks like.
Right. I'm going to ask you the questions that I always ask. What's your emotional age?
I'd say early 30s, 32. I just have never felt... When I was 32, I'd probably have said my emotional age was 18. Because I just feel... There's a photo of me in the family album when I was a little... I must have been about 5. And I've just done the dolly's washing. And I've hung it out on the line. And there's this pair of, like, knitted bloomers, like knickers for the dolls. And I've put it on and I've hung it up with 2 little pegs. And for some reason, I found that hysterically funny. And there's a photo of me just pointing at these knickers and laughing my head off. And in my heart, I'm still that girl who points at a pair of dolls' knickers and laughs and finds it hysterically funny. And I think, I don't know, I want to hold on to that emotional youth because life can get to be a bit of a grind. So I think it's important to regain your sense of being a child.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, well, it's might hearten you to know that so many older women I speak to, when you ask their emotional age, they either say that it's 5 or 6, or they say that it vacillates between their real age and their being prepubescent.
Right.
Basically. And I think that's something definitely seems to come back. Yeah,
that's
great.
I said early 30s, though, because I feel like there was a lot of anxieties in childhood and, you know, early work years. So I think 32, that's when I had our first child. And as I was talking about earlier, I sort of found my feet professionally and personally. So that was kind of like a bit of a golden age.
Give us a book recommendation. I mean, now you're doing all this reading after 10:15.
Yeah. Well, I'm currently reading The Island by Victoria Hislop, who was one of my Ladder interviewees. And as I was interviewing her, I love Greece. We go on holiday to Greece every year, several times a year. And so The Island is about this leper colony in Greece. And I've actually visited the island where it's based off Crete. So I started rereading it after I interviewed her for the Ladder because I just wanted in February, you know, a taste of that sunshine, you know, hopefully going out there over Easter and just to dream of that sunshine and the blue water and the blue sky and the amazing, I love the Greeks and their hospitality and warmth. So I wanted to relive that.
Yeah, unlike the grey sky out the window right now. What advice would you give younger women?
I just worry less. You know, I've spent so much of my time worrying and feeling that, you know, that sense of imposter syndrome and not being good enough. And life is long, you learn a lot and you know more than you think. So worry less about whether you're good enough because you probably are.
Yeah, and so many people who aren't worrying about it. Who's your old bird role model?
Another Ladder interviewee, actually, who is Joan Bakewell, who has...
I love
Joan Bakewell. And I can't remember how old she is now, but she's a pretty old bird. And she is still so sharp. And she joins me on Times Radio quite a lot to talk about the week in politics. And she always knows what's going on. She's always got a sharp analysis on it. And I love her advice on embracing change. And she talks about in the book about how her philosophy of carpe diem, and it's partly why she had an affair with Harold Pinter, because she just thought, well, I want to live life to the full. And she's done that and she's brilliant.
She's really excellent. What's your superpower?
I think it is aging, because normally that's seen as a negative for women. And I really don't think it is. I think it's, you know, the more, especially in my line of work, you know, I've been immersed in the news for nearly 30 years. So when you see, you know, what's going on in Gaza, for example, you know, you can draw on years of knowledge of that whole area and the various conflicts in the Middle East. And just that, it's like a massive filing cabinet in your brain. You can just reach for the piece of information you want. And it gives you a depth and understanding that is illuminating.
You know what? I think you're the first person to ever say that. And now you've said it, I just think, oh my God, that's so obvious and so spot on. Why has nobody ever said that before?
Well, thank you. Well, I'm pleased about that. And also, you know, over Christmas, you know, everybody was ill, and my mum got that horrible cough thing that everybody's got. She's early 80s now. And I remember just in trying to be sympathetic, I said, you know, God, aging is miserable, isn't it? It's really miserable. And she said, you know what, it's not. It's just, I feel I've accrued, pretty much what I just said. She feels she's accrued so much wisdom. And I thought about it, and I thought, I was trying to sort of be sympathetic and just say, I understand that, you know, things are a bit tough when you're constantly having to go to the doctor and this, that, and the other medical appointment. But actually, I thought it was really heartening that she could say at age 18, I think she's 81 this year, you know, actually, aging is good. You know, it's wisdom.
And how many fucks did you give?
None at all. Or very few, very few. And that goes back to the kind of theme of our conversation, that you just start to care less what people think. You know, Joan Bakewell doesn't care what people think about her. And she is liberated by that. And she has that confidence of an older woman, which, yeah, Caroline notes too, she's not as old as Joan Bakewell by any means, but she's heading there with confidence and, not giving any.
Yeah, you can't imagine Joan Bakewell scrolling through her mentions on Twitter getting stressed out, can you?
And I don't either.
So I'm going to hold that. Mm-hmm. I'm going to hold that image in my head.
Exactly.
Of Joan Bakewell.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoy The Shift and would like to show your appreciation, why not buy me a coffee? Go to www.buymeacoffee.com/theshiftwithsambaker. You can hear a new episode of The Shift every Tuesday, wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, please do rate, review, follow, tell your friends, because it really does help other people find us. And if you'd like to know more about my own experience of shifting, my book, The Shift, How I Lost and Found Myself After 40, and You Can Too, is out now in paperback.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.